Welcome to American Family Focus on Pennsylvania Issues, a weekly program discussing issues of concern to the family and those who hold traditional family values in Pennsylvania and our nation. Archives of these programs can be heard at www.afafpa.org. And now, your host, Diane Gramley, State Director of American Family Association of Pennsylvania.
What is a right-to-work state? There are currently 22 such states in the U.S. Pennsylvania is not one of them. In a right-to-work state, workers cannot be required to pay to join or pay dues or fees to a union. If you are a union member in one of those 22 states, under federal labor law and the state's right-to-work law, you have the right to resign upon membership in a union at any time. For the past 3 weeks, Wisconsin and her new governor, Scott Walker, has been in the news a lot. The unions have organized and bused people not only from Wisconsin but around the nation to descend on that state's capital in Madison. Their main concern is that Governor Walker is keeping his campaign promise to balance the budget and remove most of the public sector unions' collective bargaining rights. The unions feel threatened, but so does President Obama and the Democratic Party. They rely upon the unions to put them into office. In fact, the unions spend hundreds of millions of dollars in funding the campaigns of Democrats. The Wisconsin Democrats felt so threatened that the Senate Democrats left the state weeks ago and are still holed up in Illinois. But on Wednesday night, March 9th, they passed a revised, that is the Senate Republicans passed a revised version of the bill without Democrats present. The Assembly passed the measure by a vote of 53-42. Now, the Senate was able to advance the bill after they severed it from another fiscal provision, which was contained in the broader budget fix proposal. That allowed them to bypass a rule requiring that a quorum of 20 senators be present to vote on fiscal matters. Now, my guest today is Gary Glenn. He's the president of the American Family Association of Michigan, and he's also been involved in helping states become right-to-work states. Thanks, Gary, for being with us.
You bet, Diane. Always a pleasure.
How does the state go about becoming a right-to-work state?
Well, as you said, there are 22 of them, and eventually, by some combination of events, you have to have a bill pass both houses of the legislature and be signed into law by the governor, or in some states' cases, by citizen initiative, putting it on the ballot, and then the voters enacting it. And the 22 states have done it in either of those two ways. Idaho, in 1985, enacted a right-to-work law, and I was the leader of the organization that successfully lobbied it through both houses of the legislature. In fact, 75% of the Idaho legislature voted in favor of it, sufficient that when the Democratic governor vetoed it, the Republican legislature was able to override his veto. And so Idaho's the only state that has become a right-to-work state by overriding a gubernatorial veto. The right-to-work states are located mostly throughout the Old South and the Midwest and the Rocky Mountain region. There are none any closer than Iowa or Tennessee to the Midwest, the Great Lakes mm-hmm. states. But with our infrastructure, for example, in Michigan, the existing infrastructure, the experienced workforce, if Michigan were to pass a right-to-work law because of its dramatic effect on economic development and industrial relocation, Michigan would once again become an economic powerhouse, as it was, for example, when it was the arsenal of democracy in World War II.
Right.
Idaho went from an economic backwater to within 18 months of having passed right-to-work on the ballot in 1986 after it was enacted through the legislature. The unions put it on the ballot, outspent us $3 million to $1 million, and the people of Idaho retained the law nonetheless. And within 18 months, Idaho was number one in the nation in the creation of new manufacturing jobs and in per capita income growth. Oklahoma voters in 2001 approved a right-to-work law, and within a year or two, Oklahoma was number one in the nation in job creation and income growth. So it's not only a matter of economic development. In fact, that's secondary, far secondary, to the core principle of right-to-work, and that is individual freedom of choice, individual mm-hmm. liberty, right of conscience. As an American, if you want to join and financially support a labor union, you should be able to do so. You should be equally free to choose not to do so without fearing job discrimination and being fired for that choice either way.
Yeah, and I read another example. Governor Mitch Daniels, he repealed the collective bargaining in Indiana 6 years ago. In response to that, the government became more efficient and responsive, and the average pay for Indiana state employees actually increased
Well, so. and North Carolina and Virginia, neither one has ever allowed public employee collective bargaining. So Governor Walker in Wisconsin, the steps he has taken are actually moderate and centrist in context. Some states don't allow collective bargaining at all. And I think especially in historical context of the last century, that Governor Walker's methods and proposals will prove to be moderate and centrist. Let me give you an example, Diane. This is a letter to the National Federation of Federal Employees. It reads as follows. All government employees should realize that the process of collective bargaining, as usually understood, cannot be transplanted into the public service. The very nature and purpose of government make it impossible for union officials to bind the employer. The employer is the whole people who speak by means of laws enacted by their representatives. Particularly, I want to emphasize my conviction that militant tactics have no place in the functions of any organization of government employees. If I can just as a side note, you mean like what we've been witnessing in Madison, Wisconsin? Mm-hmm. Upon employees in the federal service rests the obligation to serve the whole people. Now, Diane, that was written by a president of the United States. Would you guess Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, Gerald Ford, Dwight Eisenhower?
No,
it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a hero of organized labor in the private sector, but who believed that in the public sector, there should be no collective bargaining, period.
Because people should be, those public sector employees should be serving the people.
Exactly. I mean, if you think about the concept of collective bargaining in the private sector, on one side of the table you have a negotiator representing the company, a private company. On the other side, a negotiator representing the interests of the members of a private association, a labor union. They make concessions, they bargain, they negotiate. As President Roosevelt said, that same concept cannot transfer to the government sector for this reason. On one side of the table, you have a negotiator who represents the best interests of all of the people, all the taxpayers. On the other side of the table, you have a negotiator representing only those taxpayers who are members of that particular private organization. Any concession whatsoever by the negotiator on the government side of the table to the interests of the union and its small sliver of the population who are members is a concession away from what's in the best interests of all taxpayers, which is why Franklin Roosevelt said there should not be any collective bargaining at all in the public sector. Let me give you some other examples.
Well,
Here's another quote.
Maybe we should send that quote around to like SEIU and the other union
right.
members.
Right. Here's another quote. It is impossible to bargain collectively with the government, unquote. Is that Newt Gingrich? No, it's George Meany, president of the AFL-CIO in the 1950s and 60s. Here, I think, is the real blockbuster, Diane. Here's a quote. In terms of accepted collective bargaining procedures, government workers have no right, let me repeat, government workers have no right beyond the authority to petition Congress, a right available to every citizen, unquote.
I mean,
who said that? The National Right to Work Committee? No, that was the AFL-CIO Executive Council in 1959.
Well, they have sure changed their tune over the last 50 years.
Well, they have, and the reason they changed their tune is because President Kennedy, you know, took office in 1961. He figured out that if federal employees were unionized, it would increase the dues flow to the political machinery that supports the Democratic Party. So John F. Kennedy issued Executive Order 10988. In 1963, for the first time, giving federal employees the right to join labor unions. And here's what that executive order said, signed by John F. Kennedy. Employees of the federal government shall have and shall be protected in the exercise of the right, freely and without fear of penalty or reprisal, to form, join, and assist any employee organization. Now, listen to this part. Or to refrain from any such activity. The head of each executive department and agency shall take such action consistent with law as required to ensure that employees in the agency are apprised of the rights described in this section and that no interference, restraint, coercion, or discrimination is practiced within such agency to encourage or discourage membership in any employee organization, unquote. Diane, what's notable about that executive order signed by JFK is that it is worded exactly, precisely, like some state right-to-work laws. It gives employees the freedom to join, or it says to refrain from any such activity. In fact, the National Right to Work Law, as recently, in fact, just this week, introduced in the United States Senate, would simply add that few, those few words to federal law, or to refrain from any such activity. John F. Kennedy signed a right to work executive order into law for federal employees. Now, in historical context, that means this. Governor Walker's proposal is more liberal in terms of granting collective bargaining rights to employees in Wisconsin than Franklin Delano Roosevelt or the AFL-CIO itself said should be the case as late as 1959. And his proposal, in part, mimics and mirrors the right to work executive order issued by President John F. Kennedy.
Well, they sure, need a history lesson, all these union higher-ups and the union workers.
Well, it's consistent, I think, with the liberal mindset that once they have achieved something, then it's the end of the world. It's going back to slavery if you take away any such quote-unquote right. There is no constitutional or other right.
But they're calling it a civil right. I mean, some of the arguments that they've used, these union workers in Wisconsin, what's a civil right that we have collective bargaining?
Oh, yeah. And the president of the Michigan Education Association is in the news today having said that if there's any restriction whatsoever on collective bargaining rights for public employees in Michigan, that it's like going back to slavery days. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. And the core principle here is, and let me tie this into the issue that you and I have talked about many times in the past. When Michigan had on the ballot in 2004 a marriage protection amendment, which constitutionally reaffirms and protects the definition of marriage as being only between one man and one woman, polls before and after the election said that two-thirds of union households in Michigan voted in favor of the marriage protection amendment. And yet all of those two-thirds of union households, many of them no doubt Christian, God-fearing, church-attending folks, were required under threat of being fired from their jobs in this state because it does not have right to work, neither does Pennsylvania, were required under threat of being fired to give money to financially support union organizations and union officials who campaigned against the Marriage Protection Amendment. And after the Marriage Protection Amendment was approved by Michigan voters, there was a lawsuit filed by the ACLU to try and limit the enforcement of our Marriage Protection Amendment. Mm-hmm. And the plaintiff in that case was a group called Pride at Work, AFL-CIO. It's the Union Federation's own in-house homosexual activist group headquartered at union offices in Washington, D.C. Their logo, I'm not making this up, is a clenched fist under which it says, Proud Union Queer. That's their language. And yet employees in Michigan, as in Pennsylvania, can be compelled as a condition of employment, continued employment, under threat of being fired, to give money every month to organizations such as the AFL-CIO, the NEA, which promote abortion on demand, which promote the homosexual agenda, the AFL-CIO
and executive... sex education for kindergarten kids.
AFL-CIO Executive Council in 2005 unanimously approved a resolution opposing all federal and state marriage protection amendments, endorsing so-called homosexual marriage, endorsing transgender rights on the job. You know, Democrat Barney Frank, openly homosexual congressman from Massachusetts, explained to us what gender identity rights on the job means. He said there are workplace situations such as communal showers where the demands of the transgender community would not pass in any Congress. I have talked with transgender activists, and what they want and what we would be forced to defend is for people with penises to be allowed to shower with other women, unquote. That's Barney Frank explaining why he wouldn't put gender identity initially until the transgender lobby beat up on him in his federal gay rights legislation. Mm-hmm. And yet the AFL-CIO has officially endorsed it, and Christian employees in your state and in Michigan are compelled to give money to these left-wing political operations or they're fired from their jobs. That's simply un-American. It ought to be illegal, as it is in 22 other states. And so hopefully at some point in our lifetimes, you'll see right-to-work legislation in both Michigan and in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, well, I know there is an effort to get right-to-work law passed. It's been an ongoing effort, but I know that there will be a bill introduced this, it may have already been introduced, this spring that would make Pennsylvania a right-to-work state. But speaking of the NEA, recently the progressives in Pennsylvania had a summit in Pittsburgh. It actually was in January. And the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette had an article and mentioned some of the speakers and the topics, and that the Pennsylvania State Education Association was one of the sponsors of the event. And the Post-Gazette quoted a teacher who said, which is astounding, he didn't realize that the PSEA was a liberal organization. My thought was, where's he been all of his life? because he has to pay the dues. But he didn't realize how liberal the organization was. But again, I'm just wondering where he's been all of his life.
Well, the AFL-CIO is a Johnny-come-lately to left-wing social issue politics. The NEA has been in the midst of it decades. We used to quote directly from the NEA handbook back when they used to praise the communist government of Nicaragua and oppose attempts to stop the communist takeover of El Salvador, and praised Fidel Castro in Cuba, and called for the legalization of marijuana, and promoted abortion on demand and affirmative action based on sexual orientation. I mean, that goes back into the 1980s. It's only been in the last decade or so that the AFL-CIO has joined the NEA in endorsing and using its members' compulsory dues money to promote a socially liberal agenda like abortion and so-called gay rights.
Now, is the AFL-CIO, is that more blue-collar workers? I don't know the difference between the unions.
Well, the AFL-CIO would include everything from airline pilots to, in some states, teachers to steel workers to, cabbies, Teamsters. All of those, even nurses. I mean, the Teamsters represent nurses in some jurisdictions. Mm-hmm.
I know the SEIU was definitely making an impact in their fight for the healthcare bill, so-called healthcare bill.
Right, and as we said, in context, FDR, an icon of the big labor movement of the last century in the private sector, didn't think the SEIU should have collective bargaining rights whatsoever. Yeah. And the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, the same, the American Federation of Government Employees. When the right to work law was passed in Idaho in the mid-80s, one of the individuals who spoke up in favor of it was an African-American man who was president of the Boise Postal Workers Union. Under John F. Kennedy's executive order, there's no compulsory unionism for federal employees, so he was not compelled to be a member of the Postal Workers Union. And he just simply said every employee in Idaho, in the private sector, in any workplace, ought to have the same freedom postal workers have under the John F. Kennedy order. And because he was black, he submitted a guest opinion, and he said the right to work is a civil rights law. It is against the law to discriminate against and fire me, he wrote, on the basis of my membership or non-membership in a certain race or creed or color or sex. He said it ought to be equally illegal to discriminate against and fire me solely on the basis of my affiliation or non-affiliation, financial support or non-support of a private labor organization. And that becomes all the more an acute point when you realize that this is not just some benevolent, charity on the corner.
Right.
This is an organization. These are organizations that are hardcore left-wing political machinery that supports almost exclusively one party in today's political culture.
Yeah, and what gets me that couple of the arguments that the union has been using there in Wisconsin, they were saying that they're trying to destroy the middle class.
Well, it's ridiculous because they're asking the middle class, private sector employees, as taxpayers, to pay more out of their pocket and their family budget so that members of the public employee union can get pay raises or not have to make contributions to their pension and health care. But, you know, the reason that 100,000 activists are in the streets of Madison, Wisconsin, is not because of the measly little contribution the governor wanted them to contribute to their health care mm-hmm. and pension funds. You probably, if you watch the news coverage, they immediately agreed to do that. They said, of course, we'll go ahead with that. If the governor asked them to make three times as big a contribution to their pension and health care, they'd immediately agree to do that. The reason they're marching in the streets and tearing up the Capitol to like $10 million worth of damage now to the taxpayers of Wisconsin is because Governor Walker's proposal gives individual public employees freedom to choose not to pay dues to the various public employee union officials.
And,
what they're upset about is they're losing their compulsory dues-funded political machinery.
Yeah, and that's losing the dues, and that's the Democratic Party's going to be hurt. But again, that's America, the freedom to do, the freedom to donate or not donate. It's all part of who Americans are. But yeah, it was very disturbing to watch all these Looney Tunes there in Madison in the state capitol tearing the place up, and they were allowed to stay there. I mean, Governor Walker bent over backwards to try to accommodate these people so they couldn't accuse him of being a totalitarian or whatever. Of course, they did anyway. But, I mean, they were in the state capitol 24 hours a day for 2 or 3 weeks. And, like you said, $10 million in damage.
Well, Thomas Jefferson said, and he was referring to situations such as the Church of England when he said this, but it certainly applies to this issue as well. He said, to require an individual to provide funds for the propagation of opinions he disbelieves is both sinful and tyrannical.
Absolutely.
And certainly that's true when someone in Michigan who supports constitutionally protecting marriage is only between one man and one woman is forced, in order to continue to be able to feed his family at his job, to give money to an organization that goes out and lobbies people to vote against constitutionally protecting marriage. One final point to just illustrate how centrist or moderate, by comparison to all these outlandish claims you hear, is Governor Walker's proposal in Wisconsin. It provides freedom of choice for all public employees except public safety employees. It expressly authorizes compulsory unionism, and I don't know why he felt the need to do this, unless it was just a political calculation, but this bill expressly authorizes and reaffirms compulsory unionism for all public safety employees like firefighters and EMTs and police officers. I mean, I certainly do not think that a firefighter or a police officer should be compelled to give money to one of these organizations any more than a steel worker or a teacher should.
Exactly.
And yet Governor Walker's proposal maintains the compulsory unionism system for safety workers. It is far from the end of the world, quote-unquote, destroy unions, ridiculous type of rhetoric, going back to slavery, just ridiculous type of rhetoric coming out of the mouths of union officials over this issue.
Yeah, and like you said, rhetoric, and they know that those type words would be what the American listener will remember. But Americans are definitely turned off by what they saw taking place in Wisconsin. The blatant attack on Governor Walker, when he didn't hide from the fact that was what his plan was. If he was elected to office, he was going to rein in the unions, and he was going to rein in the spending and the with the budget. So he was keeping his promise.
I know our time's about to run out, but let me offer one final witness here. The Wisconsin State Journal wrote yesterday. They wrote a piece about why is it, what is it that drives Governor Walker, that allows him to stand firm in the face of this kind of pressure that very few chief executives at the state level have experienced. And they reported as follows. The governor gave a hint at how he looks at the world and his place in it in a speech he gave to the Christian Businessman's Committee in 2009. Walker summed up his approach to life as trust and obey God. The son of a Baptist minister, he relayed to the crowd two anecdotes he credits with giving him political perspective. One involved the story of Jesus and Peter. In the story, Peter walked on water with Jesus' help until he lost faith and sank in the water. The other story involved two sailors, one of whom made the mistake of watching the waves break against the boat. Seeing his colleague was getting seasick, the other sailor advised the man to ignore the water and focus at a point on the horizon. That, he said, would help him ride out the storm. And here's a direct quote from Governor Walker. "Keep looking at the horizon, to the path Christ is calling you to follow," Walker told the crowd. don't focus on the waves and choppy water. That's as good an insight as any to how is it that Governor Walker has the personal fortitude and courage to continue to do what he thinks is right, even in the face of this outlandish pressure.
Absolutely. Hey, give us your website if people want to contact you.
AFAMichigan.org.
Okay, AFAMichigan.org, and I encourage folks to check out your website. Hey, take care, Gary, and appreciate your time.
Thank you. God bless you, Diane.
Okay, God bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to American Family Focus on Pennsylvania Issues. If you would like to get involved in defending traditional values in Pennsylvania, please contact the AFAFPA at Post Office Box 1048, Franklin, 16323, or visit their website at afafpa.org. The views expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views of American Family Radio, Lighthouse Ministries of Franklin, AFA, and AFAFPA.